It is Friday, October 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, bombings killed dozens of people in Afghanistan. New Zealand will have its youngest prime minister since 1856, and country music artists joined together to honor the victims of the Las Vegas shootings and the recent hurricanes. It's all ahead. Two attacks in Afghanistan Friday caused dozens of deaths. I spoke with the reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan, about the attacks, beginning with the one in Kabul.
Well, as of this moment, officials have confirmed that at least 40 people have died in this suicide blast, which occurred in a western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul. And it was, in fact, a crowded mosque for Shiite Muslims, where a suicide bomber just walked in and blew himself up. And there are dozens of people seriously wounded, according to the Afghan Interior Ministry. And in fact, what we are hearing right now is that there were two attackers. And as soon as the first one blew himself up, there was a second attacker. He was armed with automatic weapons, and he started shooting at the crowd. But security forces deployed there outside the mosque. They were able to, they located him and killed the shooter. But it seems that the death toll is likely to increase because there were more than 100 worshippers inside the mosque, including women and children. So these are the initial reports because it happened like local time around 6:30 p.m. in Kabul. And it's very difficult to get immediately quick details of these kind of attacks in the city. But we tell you that there was also another attack a couple of hours before this one happened, and that happened in the Afghan province of Ghor. That also targeted a mosque, but it was a mosque for Sunni Muslims. And what we hear right now from officials that at least 10 people also have been confirmed killed in that attack.
Have there been any claims of responsibility for either of these attacks?
Well, as of this moment, we don't have any claims either from the Taliban or loyalists of the Islamic State. And we know that in recent months, there have been repeated bombings of Shiite Muslim mosques in Afghanistan. And for all of those attacks, Islamic State, which is locally known as Daesh, has claimed responsibility for those attacks. But it is unclear whether the attack in the Ghor province, in which 10 people were killed, was the work of the Taliban insurgents or was because of some local rivalry.
Well, now, apparently this attack, the attack in Kabul, occurred just a few days after police in the city said they had arrested a would-be suicide truck bomber. And that apparently prevented a major incident.
Yes, that's true. It was a huge, like this truck that the police in Kabul seized was full of explosives that could have caused serious devastation in the city. And they were able to prevent that. And then there was another seizure by the police. Another vehicle was stopped in a part of Kabul. And they discovered that the driver was apparently a suicide bomber. And there was also explosive in it. So, yeah, police have been preventing these kind of attacks. But it seems that things are becoming more and more difficult for these nascent Afghan security forces who are not properly trained to tackle this kind of activity. I mean, that's what it suggests. If you look at the attacks over the last 1 week, including this one, I mean, at least 250 people have died over the last 4 or 5 days in Taliban attacks and in these kind of attacks. So it is quite a challenging moment for the Afghan government and nascent security forces.
That's reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, we talked about yesterday that story where a congresswoman reported that President Trump told the widow of a U.S. soldier that he knew what he was getting into, that soldier, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, when he died on a mission in Niger. Kicked off a very unusual string of events yesterday where we had the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who he himself lost his son in Afghanistan in 2010, talking about that conversation, talking about Gold Star families, which are families who have lost a child or a parent while they were serving in the military. now you have this hashtag trending, hashtag I Believe Frederica, referring to Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who made these claims. People are coming to her defense after she reported this, saying that she was there, the widow of LaDavid Johnson had this phone on speaker, and that she was able to hear what President Trump was saying. Trump supporters are firing back, using this hashtag to say she was eavesdropping on the call, she's mistaken, other things to try to discredit what she's saying. It's this political division over this issue that has a lot of people upset. And as much as you have people supporting the congresswoman or supporting President Trump and going back and forth on social media, there is a large group saying that both sides need to stop, that this is politicizing the death of a young man while he was serving his country. And a lot of people wondering, why were these troops, these four troops who died in Niger in the first place? There's a lot of questions swirling about that on social media, and a lot of people want answers about that. So this has all just become such a political firestorm, one that's getting a lot of reaction on social media, and again, prompting a lot of questions that remain to be answered. And a lot of questions, too, about the Russia investigation, which is perpetually a trending story, and security on social media. Earlier this week, Facebook said that they were going to start looking at hiring people with security clearances to monitor threats and interference from foreign actors. Well, now Facebook's chief security officer, Alex Stamos, has made some comments that suggest Facebook might be changing how the company operates in light of that news of hiring more people with security clearances. In leaked audio, Stamos said, "We have the threat profile of a defense contractor, but we run our corporate networks like a college campus." He later explained that Facebook needs a certain degree of freedom to let its engineers and staff work in a creative atmosphere. So he said college campus was kind of a figure of speech. But at the same time, Facebook needs to recognize that they're a big target. Now, it's interesting that he mentioned in that audio defense contractors, because many people who work in defense have security clearances, which would seem to fit with that shift in hiring. Facebook going to be hiring more people with clearances, maybe hiring people who have worked on defense threats and cyber threats before. But ultimately, Sarah, this means, I think, that some big changes are coming, not just to how Facebook runs as a company, but how it runs the social network. And I think before long, we're going to start to see that people around the world who use Facebook are going to see some big changes to the security profile and how that social network is run.
Very interesting. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A North Korean official says the United States must put up with Pyongyang's nuclear weapons. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will attend the first meeting between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. U.S. Senate Republicans pass a budget bill. And a report says scores of Afghan military trainees have gone AWOL while receiving training in the United States. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
9 years of research by Belgian scientists suggests that cancer loves its sugar and has a real sweet tooth. The scientists found a real connection between sugar and cancer by studying the Warburg effect, the biochemical process where cancer cells rapidly break down sugars, which in turn stimulates the growth of tumors. Johan Thieveling, a microbiologist and one of the research leaders, says that the team's studies reveals how the manic consumption of sugar by cancer cells leads to a vicious cycle of continued stimulation of cancer development and growth. He also says the team's findings explain the connection between the strength of the Warburg effect and aggressive behavior by tumors. It's thought that the results of the research could possibly lead to development of specially designed diets for cancer patients. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, New Zealand will have a new prime minister. When President Donald Trump declined to certify Iran's compliance with the Iran nuclear deal earlier this month, it put the issue back into Congress's hands. Under legislation passed in January 2016, Congress can reimpose economic sanctions if there's no recertification. In an interview this week with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren, Senate Armed Services Committee Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said Iran's behavior requires a new deal to be negotiated.
I think the status quo is unacceptable. And you got to understand that President Trump ran on the idea this was a bad deal for the world. And I think it is, and let me tell you why. Under the deal, after the passage of 15 years, the Iranians can enrich and reprocess no matter how they're behaving. And I think the Arabs are going to see it's inevitable that the Iranians get a nuclear weapon, and they're going to get one, buy one, or build one, and you got a nuclear arms race. The Congress will look at adding new conditions on the domestic Iranian deal. We're going to say that if you continue to develop ICBMs in violation of UN resolutions, we're going to reimpose sanctions. If you deny inspectors access to sites that they want to visit, then we're going to reimpose sanctions. And oh, by the way, 15 years from now, if you're still the largest state sponsor of terrorism, we're going to keep inspections in place.
All right. How do you get past the hurdle that that this was our word, that this was our agreement? The president doesn't say that they have violated the agreement, but right. This was an agreement made by the foreign administration, President Obama, and of course Europe is upset, yeah. and even our own cabinet, the president's yeah. own cabinet says it's a deal where they haven't violated.
This is an executive agreement, not a treaty. I said, let's try to make this a treaty. They said not, because a treaty is binding on the next administration. This was a deal done with President Obama and John Kerry with the international community and the Iranians. I thought it was a lousy deal. I think it's one of the worst deals I've ever seen. And President Trump has every right to change it or tear it up. And I'm glad he didn't tear it up. He says, I can't certify that the benefits to Iran are worth what we're getting.
Do you agree that they have not violated this agreement?
I don't know. I don't know if they've, some people say they, I would say this, that the whole agreement was designed to make them better people, to bring them into the family of nations. I would say since this deal, they've got worse. They've taken the $150 billion in sanctions relief, built up their military. They're toppling four Arab capitals. Assad couldn't last for 15 minutes without the Iranians. They've been provocative toward us, toward our allies in Israel. They're violating ICBM restrictions. They're trying to build a bigger military with the money. So I think this deal was bad. They've proven that they really don't want to be a member of the family of nations. And now's the time to stop them before it's too late.
Senator Lindsey Graham. Trump's decision has been controversial. In early October, 180 congressional Democrats signed a letter to Trump urging him to recertify Iran's compliance. They argue that withholding certification would harm our alliances, embolden Iran, and threaten U.S. national security. New Zealand will have a center-left coalition government led by the nation's youngest prime minister for more than 150 years. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
It's almost a month since New Zealanders voted in a general election. Neither of the two major parties, the centre-right National Party, which had been in power for nearly a decade and won more seats than its rivals, and the left-of-centre Labour Party, managed to win an outright majority in Parliament. Both had been attempting to form a coalition government following September's poll. For weeks they've been negotiating with Winston Peters, the maverick leader of the nationalist New Zealand First Party that won 9 seats in last month's election and wants to curb immigration and foreign ownership of property. Peters said he was faced with a decision between modified status quo or change and decided to go for change. He'll form a government with Labour and the Greens, another minor party. The Prime Minister will be 37-year-old Labour leader Jacinda Ardern, who only took control of her party a few weeks before the election. She says there are three main reasons why her three-party coalition will succeed.
The first is the nature of the agreements. The second is the relationships I've formed with the leaders of both parties. And the final reason, Labour has been in an agreement with New Zealand First before. We've formed a coalition government based on the majority of votes and based therefore on what the majority of New Zealanders sought in this election.
Labour campaigned heavily on trying to convince young New Zealanders with policies on education subsidies, the environment and housing. New Zealand is a former British colony in the South Pacific Ocean with a population of about 4.5 million. Elections are held approximately every 3 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Country Music Television, or CMT Artist of the Year Awards, took place this week, but in light of the Las Vegas mass shooting and disaster hurricanes, CMT ditched their traditional ceremony. Nikki Strong is here with the highlights. Nikki, first, who were the nominees, and how was the ceremony different this year?
Well, the honorees were Keith Urban, Luke Bryan, Chris Stapleton, Jason Aldean, and Florida Georgia Line. But instead of like accolades and performances that pay tribute to these artists and their accomplishments, CMT decided to switch the focus to those who have been recovering from the hurricanes and wildfires and the Las Vegas mass shooting. So the event turned into a night of, quote, hope and healing through the power of music. So there were no formal award presentations or tributes to the honorees. Instead, the honorees shared heartfelt messages to the fans. Artists performed somber tributes and songs of encouragement and inspirations. Overall, I thought it was really effective and well done.
What were your favorite moments?
There were several. I'll try to just share a few. One of them was the opening monologue, in which the honorees spoke as a group live on stage, and one by one, collectively, they pretty much paid homage to their fans, the country music community, and their unwavering commitment to the genre, the overall power of the human spirit, especially when it comes to selflessly helping others and to overcome in difficult times, the power of music to facilitate healing, and the power of unity, the overall ability to get through any tragedy or disaster, natural or otherwise, when we all come together. And it really set the tone for the whole event. Another moment was when Chris Stapleton performed Broken Halos. Oh. Broken Halos, They Used to Fly. When I just heard the song, it just resonated with me really differently. And apparently he's been singing the song in tribute to the Las Vegas victims while he's been on the road. Another great moment was Luke Bryan's words about Jason Aldean. As we know, Jason Aldean was on stage during the shooting, when it went out and began. He was actually on stage. And he's been sort of like the face of country music of that tragedy, of the Las Vegas shooting. And he's spoken. He took a couple of days off. He had to cancel shows. And so Luke Bryan, he said these words, and I really appreciated it. He talked about it could have been any one of them on stage performing. And he said, Aldean has responded with dignity, care, respect, and in some ways, defiance. And he was really proud of them. And I think that really does capture Jason Aldean's response. And on that note, when the finale came, Jason Aldean performed with Keith Urban, Chris Stapleton, and Little Big Town, and they did a cover of Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down. So, Wow. Yeah, it's symbolic in many ways because it pays tribute to a legend who was very instrumental and influenced so many artists in country music. But it's also important to note that this was the song after Jason Aldean canceled some shows. This was the first song he performed. He did a performance on the television show Saturday Night Live, and he performed that song, I Won't Back Down, as a rallying cry, really. Mm-hmm. And they ended on that note. It was good.
CMT's work to help heal through music has been more than just this award show, though.
It has. And CMT has been doing a lot of work. Kudos to them. They teamed up with Musicians on Call. Musicians on Call brings live and recorded music to the bedsides of patients in healthcare facilities. So artists volunteer their time to sing and perform, literally to help bring joy and healing to those who are sick and bedridden. And CMT made a cash donation two musicians on call, and they've been working with them to bring performers to participate. And they have, with the organization, have been sending artists to perform bedside to survivors of the Las Vegas shooting, as well as first responders and hospital staff recovering from the tragedy as well.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Very, very impressive.
And important work.
You can hear more music from these artists and more on VOA One's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Twitter and Facebook at VOA One The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You are very welcome.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
And that, of course, is music from the CMT Awards show, I Won't Back Down, an old Tom Petty song. Well, thanks a lot. That's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States applauds the courage, determination, and will of the Venezuelan people who tried to exercise their constitutional right to vote in the October 15th gubernatorial elections. Candidates loyal to the authoritarian regime of President Nicolas Maduro claimed victory for 18 of 23 governorships contested in the October 15th elections, according to the regime-controlled National Electoral Council, or CNE. But opposition leaders rejected both the process and the tally, citing exit polls that indicate their candidates won many more states. Opposition members decried that voting sites were shifted to distant neighborhoods at the last minute, confusing and imposing barriers to voters in opposition strongholds. The government-stacked CNE issued bad-faith, misleading ballots, including opposition candidates who already lost in the primaries. No independent international observation was allowed, and the CNE also denied accreditation for one of Venezuela's most important independent observer groups to monitor the election. In essence, then, the regime says of the results, "Take our word for it." "We encountered an absolutely fraudulent system," said Carlos Ocariz, the opposition candidate in Miranda, the nation's second most populous state, where the candidate of the ruling Socialist Party won. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert condemned the lack of free and fair elections, noting the voice of the Venezuelan people was not heard. She said, "Our previously stated concerns were unfortunately realized. Lack of independent, credible international observers. Lack of technical audit for the National Electoral Council's tabulation. Last-minute changes to polling station locations without public notice. Manipulation of ballot layouts. And limited availability of voting machines in opposition neighborhoods." As long as the Maduro regime conducts itself as an authoritarian dictatorship, the United States will work with members of the international community and bring the full weight of American economic and diplomatic power to bear in support of the Venezuelan people as they seek to restore their democracy. The United States continues to call on the regime to provide for the humanitarian needs of its people, respect the Constitution and National Assembly, allow a true democratic process, and release all political prisoners.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.